My name is Bill, and I'm an addict.
Hi, Bill.
And I'm also an alcoholic, and I don't really care which. You know, addict, alcoholic. And the reason I don't care is because I have a disease, and it applies to alcohol, it applies to drugs, and if you have the same disease, then you can insert what you can identify, you can do whatever you want to identify yourself with that disease. What I have found out is the cure for all of that, for me, is the same, and it's the 12 steps that are in this book called Alcoholics Anonymous, or I have shortened it to NOMO. Shortcuts. My sponsor was supposed to be here tonight. All kinds of accidents happened in our life in the last 24 hours, okay? My mother-in-law, who lives on the island of St. John in the U.S. Virgin Islands, and her sister, they were supposed to be here tonight, and my mother-in-law had a rollerblading accident yesterday and broke her arm, okay? We're hard chargers. And then my sponsor, his name is Weldon. He was going to be the guy to introduce me. His wife got sick this morning, and they had to go to the hospital. She's okay. But I have a whole section over here. Give me a wave. Like, yay! I have a whole section of people over there. And that's because if you have alcoholism, like I have alcoholism, you need that much, just like over almost 200 years of sobriety over there, and that's the kind of support system that I need in my life to keep me sober. I don't know about you guys, I started out very young, and so I have a really long history, and I could bore you with that, but I asked my sponsor a couple of weeks ago, I told him, Chris had called and said, hey, would you come out and tell your story? He said, yeah, sure. And I said, so, well, then what should I do? And I can do this because he's not here and I won't get in trouble. I do a great Weldon impersonation. So I said, well, then, what's your advice? He said, well, just don't get up there and tell a drunk a lie because I can't sit through it and those people deserve better. And the truth is that if he was here and I got off on a drunk lie, he wouldn't sit through it. He would probably throw a shoe at me to stop me. So the real truth is that you deserve better. As my wife alluded, I was a client here a little less than 4 years ago. I had something happen to me about, which direction? This direction, about 50 yards away from here, over in room 2 on the left side of that building. That changed my life forever, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. But, like, I know when I was here, the last thing I wanted to hear was someone to come out and tell me how to smoke crack. I knew how to smoke crack, you know. I knew how to smoke meth. If there was a drug to be done, I knew how to do it. I didn't need someone to come out here and compare stories with me because chances are I did more than him or he did more than me. Big deal. You know, I'm here to get better. That's what I was here for, and I really didn't need to hear it. And besides that, we told enough of those war stories out back at the smoking area, so we didn't need to hear it when we came over here. He did tell me, though, to qualify a little bit, and what I'll tell you is that I did start very young, 8, 9 years old, really young. When I was in the fifth grade, I got caught getting ready to jab a hypodermic needle in my arm. And thank God I got caught because it was full of fountain ink. And I have no idea I take that back. I do know what I was thinking. It was the late 60s, early 70s. And what I would see on TV every night are these long-haired people that looked like they were having a great time and they'd stick something in their arm and then they'd be in utopia. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to be in utopia. And whatever my situation was at the moment, it was bad enough that that looked better. And I didn't care how I got there. I was going to get there. And that's how I used. And, by the time I was 14 or 15 years old, I had a little posse. You know, there were like 7 of us that hung out thick and thin everywhere. We took our first drinks together. We smoked our first joints together. Some of us lost our virginity to each other. It was our little core group, right? And so one night, For whatever reason, myself and another guy were not with them. And the other five got some bad dope and a bad needle. And then within 48 hours, they were all dead. The next week I spent, I was a pallbearer at four of the funerals, went to all five. And I just, man, I went on this spiral. You know, it was just like blotted out. Don't deal with it. And it was real clear to me right up until then that's what I did. But then when I became 18, things got really confusing. And what I mean by that, in the big book, it talks about three types of drinkers, okay? So if you're a heroin addict, you can insert the word heroin user or do what you need to do to make this fit. But I think it applies because it talks about the disease and not the substance. But in the big book, they talk about alcohol, and so they refer to them as drinkers. They talk about three types. First of all, they talk about a moderate type, and then they talk about a hard drinker. I'm going to call it a problem drinker. And then they talk about the real alcoholic. So that moderate drinker, they describe like this. They say it's a guy that can take it or leave it alone. That's the guy I wanted to be my entire life. I wanted to be that. I wanted to be the guy that, like, when he got off of work, he went home. He went home to his nice house. He got down this really heavy crystal glass and pulled down his 28-year-old scotch, and he poured exactly two fingers of scotch, and he sipped. And when he went to bed, there was a finger of scotch left. That's a moderate drinker. They can take it or leave it alone, and that's the guy I wanted to be. I wanted to be that guy. I wanted to be that guy when I got off of work and I said I was going out to happy hour to have a beer with my friends, that's what I did. I got off of work. I went to happy hour. I had a beer with my friends, and I went home. If I had two beers with my friends, I called a cab. That's the guy I wanted to be. I wanted to be the guy, that moderate drinker, the guy that, like, if I got dressed up on Saturday night and said I was going out to the club, I went out to the club, and if I ran into my friends in the bathroom and they had a little fold of Coke and everybody was doing a bump, I did a bump of Coke, but I went home. And I'd have a hard time getting to sleep, but I didn't have to take a handful of benzodiazepines to get there. That's the guy I wanted to be, right? But the fact that I want to be that guy so much tells me that I'm not that guy. I'm not that guy. I know I'm not that guy. But this is where it got confusing. I got to the age of 18, and I joined the Navy. And there's a whole story behind that. It turned out to be the best thing I ever did in my life. But I joined the Navy, and all of a sudden, I was able to take it or leave it alone. And in fact, most of the times, I left it alone. I joined the Navy, and what it says in the book is this is a guy that has an occasional bender, that sometimes he drinks a little bit too much, but not all the time. And he may even cause a few little problems, but like there comes a time in his life that he has this life-changing event, and it gives him the courage, the strength, whatever it is, to leave it alone. To moderate or leave it alone altogether, and that's exactly what happened to me. I joined the Navy. I ended up getting married. We had a child. I started to get an education because of the Navy. I had a purpose, and alcohol and drugs seemed to be unimportant to me at all. Now, I can tell you today, I am not that hard drinker type. I am not a problem drinker. I'm something else entirely, and we'll get to that in a minute. But what happened was I had another life-changing event. That little boy that we had, he was born with a congenital heart disease, and he went, at the age of three, he went to his babysitter's one day. He had a great morning. He had a great lunch. He laid down to take his nap after his lunch, and he never woke up. Never woke up. And man, all that grief that I had when I was 14 years old for those five people, you know, started coming forward. And in the middle of that, he and his mother and I were in the middle of a separation, and the loss of that marriage started twirling around like that. And then here comes that atomic bomb to set it off, man. And I did what I knew how to do, man. I buried that stuff in drugs and alcohol for the next 8 years. And, you know, as fate would have it, I ended up in New York, just outside the city. I got involved in some relationships I shouldn't have been involved in. Anybody identify with that? Okay. I got involved with some people I shouldn't have been involved in, some business I shouldn't have been involved in. And because of that, I ended up in a court I wish I had never gone to, you know. And the court introduced me to AA, and that was in 88. It took me until 93 to finally put stuff away and not use drugs and alcohol again. And I got sober in 93, and I stayed sober, like my wife said, for 13 years. But what I did not know then that I can look back at now is I never really got past the fact that I was confused of what kind of alcoholic I was, or what kind of drinker I was. I still thought that I was a hard drinker, a problem drinker, not a real alcoholic. That's for you guys. I'm not me. You know, I can take it or leave it alone. And so for the next 13 years, I stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got involved, and I went to meetings, and I did. A lot of good things happened in those 13 years. I met my lovely wife, right? I went back. I had dropped out of school when those five people died. I dropped out of school. I went back to school. I got my high school equivalency. I worked at a community college here in Austin, was able to get into the University of Texas, got an undergraduate degree. My wife talked me into doing an MBA. I did an MBA. I did some postgraduate work. I kept getting these promotions at work. I was a senior director. I was reporting directly to the CEO. It was awesome. I was awesome, man. Did you hear any spiritual achievement at all? None. Because all I did was enough. I was working a maintenance program in Alcoholics Anonymous that was just enough that if you asked me, I could tell you who my sponsor was. He might not know who I was, but I knew who he was, right? And I'd go to a couple of meetings a week so people would know me, you know. Hey, there's Bill. Hey, how you doing? Gotta go, you know. I didn't do the work at all. And so after 13 years, what happened was all that success started really working on my head, and I started having this anxiety, and I couldn't sleep at night. And so I went to my doctor, and she said, oh my gosh, you're so lucky. We just came out with this new drug called Ambien. It will help you sleep. And I said, that's what I need, is some of that right there. And she gave me a bottle of Ambien and told me to take a half of one every night. Well, if I slept that good off a half of one, man, imagine how I could sleep if I took six of these bad boys, you know? And that's the kind of alcoholic or drug abuser that I am, right? If a half is good, six is great, you know? I can't wait to get to six. That little bit of taste of whatever it was eventually led me to a drink. And in 2006, I took a drink. And I am that guy. Okay, so if you ever are in a meeting and you ever hear about a guy that, yeah, he was sober for a long time, he got drunk, and that night he was in jail, I am that guy. It does happen. I started drinking about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and by 11:30 that night, I was in Williamson County Jail with a DUI. And so I got out, you know, and you know what? You hear that 777-7777? That shit works, man. I had a cell phone, all my number. I couldn't remember my wife's number, you know. Not that I wanted to call her, but, like, I couldn't remember it. And so I called, the sevens, and they got me out, man. I got out, and I was walking down the road, and she did. A friend of hers found me walking down the side of the road, and I was so ashamed, so embarrassed, because all I knew was work and AA. I didn't have any between. I didn't have friends. I just had work and AA, you know. And I had to go back to AA, and I had so much self-shame. Self-pity, self-remorse, whatever. Well, I just, man, I hated it. I could never get past, I never let go. I never got past that shame that I felt about taking a drink of alcohol. And so it stayed with me, and I hung in there, I think, another 4, 5, 6 years. But somewhere about halfway in between there, I got to thinking. You know, I'm still in that job. Somehow I saved that job. I kept that job. So I still got that all-important job, and I got all the window dressings that go with it. And man, I just needed something. And obviously drinking was not the answer for me. You know, I got that when they put the handcuffs on and drug me away. Okay, that's not going to work. But, man, those pills, you can't smell the pills, you know. But how – I'm thinking. Hold on. I'm thinking because I got – I'm going to figure this out. But she'll only give me 20 of those for a month. And that's 2 days worth. God. So but I found this place online where you could order 1,000 at the time. So I always, listen, I figured out a system. Sometimes they would get caught in customs and they'd get turned back. So that meant, well, I've always got to have a shipment in play. So you 3 shipments all the time flowing through the system so that, like, I would make... I thought about this day, listen, so that I'd always have 1,000 in my hand, so that, because that was my number. If I didn't have 1,000, I'd start to kind of, you know, what am I going to do, you know? And so, but then what happened was, how many people chewed bars when they were out there? God, it's awesome, isn't it? Fuck it. Oh. But you begin to start, you forget shit. And you start dozing off like you're a heroin addict. You're like doing that nod thing. People go, man, are you on heroin? No, my arms are clean. What the? You know? So I needed a pick-me-up. That's what I needed. I needed something to lift me up. And I thought, well, God, Coke is good. Coke will work. And crack would be even better. And so I started smoking crack. You know, I'm 51, 52 years old. I've got this great job. And why I'm telling you this is because this disease, it doesn't care. You know, the disease I got, it doesn't discriminate. It doesn't say, oh, your zip code's what? Oh, well, then you're just going to drink scotch. That's not how it works with me, you know. Like, I didn't give a shit. I got out there, and I did the deal and everything that went with it. Everything that goes with the smoking the crack and chewing the bars, I took it all in. I embraced it, man. I was that. But I'm living this double life. I can't go home and tell her, you know. She's 30-something years in AA, and all those people, my friend, I'm traveling all over the world with these people. And they know something's wrong. they can't put their finger on it. They're like something. My friend Jim there, one time he told me after all this, he says, I really thought you were going crazy. He said, I thought we were going to have to take you to an insane. And I was going crazy. I was going crazy because I was a drug user. You know, I was an alcoholic, untreated alcoholic in the middle of alcoholism. And so all of that came to a head one night. My wife was at a AA convention in Colorado because that's what sober people do. I was in my mom's basement smoking crack because that's what crack addicts do. And I had started going into these psychosis episodes where I wouldn't remember. You know, I'd be up for days at the time, and I wouldn't remember things. And so I wrote her this long email, evidently, that detailed the last 3 or 4 years. I mean, everything, every part of that lifestyle, and sent it to her. Didn't remember it, you know. And so the next morning when we talked, she called me and said, what are you going to do? And I am not kidding you. I don't think I've ever shared this with her. I literally thought she meant, what are you going to do today? Like, where are you going to lunch? What are you going to do with your mom? And but she said, what are you going to do about the money, the crack, the women, the drugs, the stealing, the lying, the cheating? And so what ended up happening is exactly what she said. She told me that she still loved me, she still cared about me, but she could not be anywhere near me. I'm toxic, you know. And that she was locking up the house, locking down the bank accounts, figuring out her exit strategy, but in the process she would help me get help if I wanted help. And on August 2nd, 2013, I ended up at the Austin Recovery Detox. And some of you may not know about it, but like, we used to have a detox center over at Cross Park, and it was a medical facility. You would go in and you could do detox, and I got there on the 2nd. I literally walked in and handed the lady at admissions a hot crack pipe. I took a hit in the parking lot and walked down. Surprised I didn't fill up the lobby with smoke when I walked in. I handed her this pipe, and she goes, what is that? And I go, it's a crack pipe. She goes, ah! And then I had a pocket full of benzos, so I took a handful of benzos and ate those and passed out in the lobby. And sometime later, I don't know, because the next time I woke up, I was on the other side in blue scrubs on a bed in AR detox. And they kept me there. I guess I didn't tell the exact truth of the amount of drugs I was using, because they sent me out here on Monday. So that was a Friday. My sober date is August 3rd, that Saturday. And that Monday I was here. And so I got here, and that Wednesday I started having like these mini seizures because I started coming down off the benzos. And if anybody's ever done that amount of benzos and then just stopped, it doesn't quite work that well, you know. And a guy that had kicked heroin at the detox center helped me get through it. He said, you know, just go to your, tell him you're sick, you can't go to meetings today. Take a shower, a warm shower, not a hot shower, not a cold shower. I'll never forget, his name was Sam. And he said, and then just turn off the lights and get quiet. And what I didn't know what he was telling me to do, I know this today, he's telling me to meditate. Just stop and meditate. And I was able to get quiet enough that Wednesday and that Thursday that I was able to get through it without going to the hospital. And so, you know, it probably took another week before I really got my thoughts together. And the very next thought I had this thought been my last thought here, I would not be here today. I hope that makes sense. But my next thought was, 2 weeks into the treatment here, my next thought was, I need to get my phone. Because if I get my phone, I can get in touch with my Connect, and I can have drugs waiting for me when I leave here in 2 weeks. I leave here in 2 weeks, I can get drugs. And I'm working that fast in my mind, trying to figure out how to get my phone. How do I break the lock off the personal effects locker so I can, you know, and then put it back together so they won't know, you know. And if that had been my last thought, I wouldn't be here. But the next thought is what changed everything. Because the next thought, remember that confusion I was telling you about, how I thought I was a hard drinker or a problem drinker and how I wanted to be a moderate drinker? The next thought is what cleared it up to me. How fucking insane is that? I'm in a treatment center to get off of drugs and alcohol, and I'm trying to line up my Connect so that when I get out, I can go right back to it. And I'm leaving in 2 weeks. How crazy is that? It's insane. It's insane. I am powerless over drugs and alcohol. And it occurred to me, holy shit, I'm powerless over drugs and alcohol for the first time. All the history that I've ever had with it, I always thought that, like, somehow, some way, I could manage my way through this thing. I could not do drugs and alcohol through willpower or some manipulation. And it occurred to me that I can't. I am powerless over it, no matter what. And it talks about this in the big book. It talks about that the alcoholic reaches a point that he cannot bring into his consciousness with sufficient force the misery and suffering of the consequences of using drugs and alcohol. It says that. And it doesn't say that I can't remember, because I could remember it all. I could, God damn, my wife wasn't even talking to me yet. How could I forget, you know? I could remember it, but I could not bring it in with sufficient force to stop myself. I'd still choose the drugs and alcohol over anything else because I couldn't bring it into my consciousness with sufficient force. And so it was that's my moment of clarity. That's my spiritual awakening. That's my moment where I no longer had to think of myself as a hard or problem drinker. I could go ahead and say, you know what? Shit, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a real alcoholic. I'm a real drug user. So what do I do about it? And what happened next, it's a blur to me how it happened, but I was here for 30 days. In the next 24 hours, somehow, I moved from the 30-day program to the 90-day program. And I stayed here for another 75 days. And during that 75 days, I started coming to the meetings here in Troll Hall with a little bit more purpose. I got on the bus to do the outside volunteer work. If I could get to a meeting outside of here, I'd do that. And man, by the time those 75 days were up, I was feeling pretty good. I thought I had this thing. I thought I had some good information, man. And I got out there in the real world, and I found out that, like, man, it had just, not only had it kept moving, it was moving a lot faster than I remembered it, you know. Take your time in here, man. Enjoy it. Because the world's still moving out there, and it's going to be moving when you get out there, no matter when that is. And so for that first year out of here, I thought I was Mr. Recovery. Man, I had like four or five sponsees. I did H&I meetings. I came out here, Lisa and I were just talking about it. I'd come out here like every other Wednesday. I used to have an alumni panel where alumni people would sit here and tell you what happened like after they left so you could get some idea. And I used to come out here every Wednesday. They'd have me, you know. And I was doing all this stuff, and I had a sponsor, and I was doing some work, but I was really busy carrying the message. And what happened was I ended up getting this commitment on a Monday night Cocaine Anonymous meeting. And the commitment was treasure. And so once a month, I had to go a little bit early because there was an AA meeting that met right before the CA meeting, and that's the guy you had to give the money to. His name was Charlie. And so once a month, I'd go a little bit early, and I'd give Charlie the money. And then one month, for some reason, I said, you know what, I think I'm going to go really early and just go to both meetings because I got nothing else to do. Might as well. And so I went, and there was this old guy there. His name was Weldon. He ends up being my sponsor. But I came to the meeting, and he pulled me around after the meeting, and he said, this shit about coming to our meetings half-assed ain't going to fly. You need to come, or you need to give that commitment up. And so Weldon, when I first met him, he scared me. Now, he still scares me for a whole lot of other reasons now. But, like, I said, okay. And so I started coming to, I went to two meetings every Monday night, my 6 o'clock AA meeting and my 7:30 CA meeting. And eventually the CA meeting fell apart, but I go to the same meeting on Wednesday night now. But up until a few months ago, I still went to that 6 o'clock AA meeting on Monday night. Well, I'm still, my recovery, Mr. Recovery ego is still this pretty big, you know? And I need some fodder. I'm thinking, so Weldon got sober in 1959. He got sober before I was born, and that's a long time ago. And I thought, man, what a great bullet point on my recovery resume. If I could get that guy, I didn't want him as a sponsor. I just wanted him to take me through the steps. I thought, man, if I could just say, yeah, well, you know, I've been through the steps, one of the real old timers, that would be awesome. And so I asked him. He, you know, I went out after the meeting, sits on the same bench still today. And I went out there and I sat next to him and I said, hey, he says, ha. I said, do you still take people through the steps? He says, I've been known to on occasions. I said, would you be willing to take me through the steps? He says, that would be interesting. And it was. And he said, well, you've got a sponsor. You need to go ask your sponsor. So I asked my sponsor. My sponsor knew Weldon, and he said, yeah, it'd be great. And, we started working together. And so the way it started was this. I told him, I said, okay, I can meet with you, but I can't meet with you during the day on weekdays. He says, great. See you Tuesday at 1 o'clock. I said, no, you don't understand. He says, I heard it, everything you said, Bill, and you need to hear what I said. Your time is Tuesday at 1 o'clock. And I said, okay. So the first time I showed up, I was 10 minutes late, and his door was locked, and I knocked on it. He says, come back when you can be on time. So I came back next Tuesday at 1 o'clock. I was there 5 minutes early, and we started working on the steps. And I guess it was, man, I don't know, like maybe 2 months, 3 months into it, he says to me one day, no kidding, he says, man, I've been thinking about our Tuesday at 1 o'clock. And I'm thinking, yeah, finally. He goes, you've been a case. I think we need to meet at Thursday at 10, well, Tuesday at 1 o'clock, Thursday at 10 a.m. I said, well, no, I can't change days. He says, no, I'm not asking you to change days. You need 2 days a week. And I said, I can't meet at Thursdays at 10 o'clock. I have a meeting that I do with the bookkeeper, and I can't move that. He says, you're going to have to move it because you're meeting with me at Thursdays at 10 a.m. and Tuesdays at 1 p.m. And we started, and what he was teaching me was not that he was a hard ass, but that, like, I needed, no matter how important I thought I was, I needed to put my recovery first. That no matter what title I had or what position I aspired to, none of that meant shit unless I was doing this, you know. The other thing he did for me when we first started working together, he had me fire all my sponsees, give up all my commitments, except for one. He let me keep a meeting that, like, I was treasurer for on Tuesday. I don't know how I ended up in how do you make a crack addict treasurer? I had 3 treasury commitments at one. People just don't think. But he let me keep one. And his point there was that, this one, I know what his point was because he told me. He said, Bill, if you want to carry a message, you must have a message. And the message you're carrying right now is not one I want you toting anywhere. So he made me give it up. And we worked for like 18 months on the steps, to get through the steps. Some of them went really quick. My sixth and seventh step, we probably spent 6 months on. It was intense. When I did my fifth step with him, he asked me, he said, well, while we're doing this fifth step, I want you to make some notes on the side of your character defects. And I came up with 8, 9 really good character defects. He came up with 33 defects, okay? And so, like, I was, you know, then came the time where we got to negotiate, you know, my list versus his list. And so one of them that really stood out to me, and this is how this disease and the delusion of this disease fools me, right? So, and it's a great example because I can talk about it in mixed company. It's simple. Everybody gets it. So the character defect was gluttony. Okay? I work hard. I think I was in pretty good shape, even back then. And I thought, gluttony, come on. Gluttony, really? And he said, okay, let's talk about your diet. And so we're going through my diet the whole day, what I eat for breakfast. And we get to the nighttime. He says, well, do you have a treat? And I go, yeah. He says, what do you have? I said, I have a glass of milk and four Oreos. He says, four Oreos? He says, tonight I want you to have just two. And this was on a Tuesday. And the reason I know that is because I sweated from Tuesday night when I could only have two, Wednesday night when I could only have two, till I got back to his house on Thursday morning. And he said, how did that go? And I told him, I've been sweating since Tuesday night. I feel like you've taken something away. And he says, that's my point. He says, we all have a little bit of it in us. We all have a little bit of that gluttonous. When we suffer from this disease, that stuff feeds over into our daily activity. Something as simple as two versus four cookies causes us to get that uptight. Now, what he told me next really made my life easier. He said, you know, you could have always gone back. I just asked you to get two to start with. If you want two more, you can go back. And the cool thing? Well, here's the cool thing. I have never found it necessary to go back for the other two Oreos. Just knowing that I could have them, it was enough. It's okay. They're there. They're set. I go check on them in the middle of the night. Yep, they're still there. It's good, you know. It's awesome. But here's what I'll tell you. I'll kind of wrap up with this, and that's pretty much what happened. You know, that's what happened is I got connected with somebody that worked for me. And if I have any piece of advice for anyone, it's find someone that works for you. Now, I've chosen sponsors before because they had really cool cars, really cool houses, really cool wives, and none of that shit worked for me. Weldon, he's got a really cool wife. He's got a really cool house. He's got a really cool car now, come to think of it. But that wasn't why I chose him. I chose Weldon because I wanted a bullet point on my ego, you know, resume of Mr. Recovery. And what that tells me is that God directed me directly to who I wanted. He got me there the only way he could get me there. God leveraged my ego to get me in front of the person that is the person for me, right? And so the message there is let go, you know. This now that I know that I'm a real alcoholic, now that the confusion is gone, it's easier for me to let go. I won't say that it's easy. It's easier. It's less difficult for me to let go. I still hang on to some shit, like both hands, just grabbed it, got it, won't let go of it. But I have a support group. I have a people around me that I can talk to about it and kind of get centered on it. I have a group of guys on Monday night, so here's what it's like. I have a group of guys on Monday night. We call it our accountability group, our secret handshake club. And we meet for dinner, but we also, there's six of us, and we go around the room and we fess up, man. What steps are you working on? How many sponsees you got? How many meetings did you go to? How many nightlies did you do? We're like this with each other, and that helps me immensely. You know, Thursday night is the date night with my wife, the same wife that locked down the bank accounts, locked the house, and told me she couldn't be with me. You know, she told that much better than I could ever tell that, is that, like, there was no hope. I had resigned the first probably 30, 35 days that I was here. I'd resigned to the fact that my life would not include her and started planning what I was going to do when I got out as a sober, single guy with nothing going for me. And that didn't happen. I've got, like I said, my crew is here, and half of them didn't show up because they're injured from, like, these extreme sports, you know. we're a bunch of kick-ass people that have fun. That's what it's like today. And I'm not about to stand up here and tell you what your life is going to be like when you get out of treatment, because I don't know. It could be much greater than the life I have. It could be a little bit less than the life I have. Here's what I can tell you, is that if you'll get involved in this program, if you'll find somebody that can be that conduit to that message like I did, my experience is your life will be better than it was before you got here, okay? I don't know what it looks like before. I don't know what it looks like after, but it will be better afterwards if you get with this thing and stay with this thing. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe you're a moderate drinker. Maybe that's you. Maybe you're the guy that can take it or leave it alone, you know? Or maybe you're the hard drinker or the problem drinker, the guy that just, or girl, that just needs a life-changing event to moderate or leave it alone. But what I will tell you that is if you're here, it's most likely you're not a moderate drinker, okay? I'm not going to diagnose you, but like I'll put some good money that if you're here, moderate was not in your vocabulary, okay? Only you can decide between the hard or problem drinker and the real alcoholic. But if you're here and the thought has gone through your mind about using when you get out, my experience was that classified me as a real alcoholic. And so I'll leave you with that thought. Thank you.